You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Months before the March on Washington, on April 12, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, and placed in solitary confinement. While he was there, he read a newspaper article in which a group of white clergymen argued that civil rights protests were extreme and untimely. In response, Dr. King wrote an impassioned rebuttal, which has become known as the Letter from Birmingham Jail. In a book called Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed the Nation, Jonathan Ryder, a professor of sociology at Columbia University, has done a close analysis of this pivotal document and how it would inspire not only the marches in Birmingham and Selma, but peaceful protesters from Tiananmen to Tahrir Squares. It's published by Bloomsbury Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jonathan Ryder to our show today. Hello.
Nice to be here.
Your previous book, The Word of the Lord is Upon Me, was about the style and performance of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches. But for this book, you focus on the substance of what he said and wrote. Does his written work differ from the speeches and sermons?
Well, King wasn't primarily a writer. He was a man of the oral tradition, and what's interesting about Letter from Birmingham Jail is it's atypical in many ways. His books, there are often ghostwriters that were heavily involved. There's a collaborative process. So there's some stilted prose in a lot of it. But the letter is really, I think of it as an oral form of written work. And well, sometimes you can hear the preacher cadence in it.
Although there's a story about when King first spoke at the Lincoln Memorial at a prayer pilgrimage for freedom in 1957, Bayard Rustin proposed some changes in his prepared speech, and King waved him off and said, "Bayard, I don't mind you criticizing my ideas, but I don't like you criticizing my words because I'm better at words than you are."
Well, I think, you know, that's a perfect indication of King's confidence of his artistry. We think of him, obviously, above all else, as a minister. That's what he thought, a prophetic minister. He was a civil rights leader. But there was a third aspect of him, is the artistry of expression. And he had great pride. And again, the night before the March on Washington, when everyone was besieging him with ideas, at a certain point he retreated and said, "You know, I'm going to consult with the Lord now." You know, and that was, again, the virtuosity of the man primarily in the oral mode.
And he drew upon the things that we often hear in black churches. Some of the terms, sometimes he would quote from gospel songs.
You know, the hip-hop generation thinks they invented sampling, as if borrowing and synthesizing was theirs. King was a master mixmaster. And that's why the effort to try to figure out, oh, these are black sources, or he's quoting liberal Protestant preachers like Harry Emerson Fosdick, and then there's a Keats quote, but that's not as authentic as the gospel. King never made those distinctions by race. And so he would mix together these collages of sound, drawing from, again, Keats or a spiritual, or, you know, the Lord will make a way out of no way. And even when he was in more refined mode, he would often have that black preacherly vibrato. Oh, I know it's not easy to love the white man. So absolutely, he drew wherever he could, but the black sources were always there.
Did he address the same issues in the Letter from Birmingham Jail that he did in the I Have a Dream speech?
Well, the two are symbiotically entangled, powerfully, and people don't always realize it. There are passages in Letter from Birmingham Jail that migrate. There are King gave an amazing mass meeting speech that's really a black preach version of Letter from Birmingham Jail right after he got out of jail in Birmingham. The end of that appears in I Have a Dream. So, but they're different functions, because in one, he's angry at those white critics who have chastised him and accused him, the apostle of nonviolence, of precipitating violence. By the time he gets to Washington, the whole political environment of the summer has changed. There's a feeling there's a breakthrough. Black protest is spreading throughout the South to the North. John Kennedy has given his speech. So at the march, he's very cognizant of the civil rights bill, and it explains why the first half of I Have a Dream is a rather stiff speech. It's not his best till he throws it down. But what remains the same, if you look submerged in I Have a Dream, are the themes that are really heightened in Letter from Birmingham Jail.
Well, before he was arrested in Birmingham, he had been arrested twice in Albany, Georgia, but in very different way.
Well, absolutely.
Was he going to be arrested? Did he expect to be arrested?
In Albany or in Birmingham?
In any of these protests.
Well, in Birmingham, they clearly had an idea that perhaps going to jail would be necessary to be the sacrificial act on Good Friday. He would suffer as his savior suffered to dramatize to the world. But the actual decision to go to jail, Good Friday was April 12th. April 10th, he hints that he's going to jail. All Thursday, he's in a state of indecision and paralysis while his buddy, Ralph Abernathy, says, "Bull Connor, get the cell ready. We're coming tomorrow." And Abernathy has the powerful confidence that he's going ahead. King is faltering. He's disappointed in blacks. He's depressed. And so the decision to go to jail is finally made in the wee hours of Friday, of Good Friday. And he does that because he feels we're going to fail here in Birmingham like we did in Albany. We've got to do something.
But to some degree, the failure in Albany was because of the way the local sheriff, Laurie Pritchard, handled the situation.
Well, you know,
he was a lot cleverer than Bull Connor, or perhaps less of a racist.
You know, leave aside the issue of who was, he was a more clever racist, to be sure. And so he had designed the ultimate moderate approach that if we do not act brutally, the New York Times is not going to become interested. The Washington Post is not going to become interested. So here they go into Birmingham waiting that Bull Connor is not going to do the gentle approach. If Laurie Pritchard killed them with kindness, they thought, in fact, Bull Connor might kill them. And Andrew Young told me the story, you know, that January meeting when they're deciding to go all in Birmingham. And King says, "I want you all to think about this. Some of you in this room may not come back alive from Birmingham." And Andrew Young said, "He was teaching us to accept the possibility of our own death." And then King would preach their, you know, funerals. "You all think they're going to get me, but you all be jumping out in front of the camera and they're going to get you. But I will preach you the best funeral you ever had." So the death.
He's trying to find some humor in this scary experience.
You know, King backstage with his fellow black colleagues was somewhat of a badass, sarcastic, a brilliant mimic, and hilarious. And he hid that behind the mask of dignity. But they did realize that in Birmingham, the danger was undeniable, and Bull Connor stymied them because he was held in check briefly. You know, at least he didn't lose it until after King got out of jail.
Well, he had connections to the KKK, and we're also talking about a time when George Wallace had just recently been elected governor of Alabama. The feeling was they were going to hold the line in Alabama.
Wallace's speech in January 63 is a classic. And Martin Luther King always admired Wallace as an orator. He said he has only four speeches, but he hones them till they're masterpieces. They're classics, right? And so he never underestimates. He's the most dangerous racist. But what did Wallace say? Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. The day that King, 2 days after King gets out of Birmingham jail and things are not going forward, being in jail didn't spur things, King gives this incredible performance in a black mass meeting. And you hear his voice shaking. And we say, and then he goes, you know, "Freedom now, freedom tomorrow, freedom forever." He's really rebutting Wallace.
They knew Bull Connor was scary because he was involved in the attack on freedom riders at Birmingham Trailways, that famous attack on May 14th, 1961. That's just a couple of years earlier.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's widely believed, and I think Diane McWhorter established this, Bull Connor gave the Klan, said, "You basically have 15 minutes. So he held back the police and allowed the Klan to do their dastardly act, and then they disappeared.
My guest is Jonathan Ryder. His latest book, Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed the Nation. How would you describe King's relationship with both President John F. Kennedy and Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy at the time?
Well, it was a tense and ambivalent relationship. They were opposites in many ways. King looked on the Kennedy administration and President Kennedy as the epitome of the moderate who is the object of his wrath in Letter from Birmingham Jail. And midway through the letter, when King switched from diplomat trying to convince whites to the prophet chastising them, he says, "I must confess my disappointment." And his first is in the white moderate. And what does he say about the moderate? They paternalistically think they can set the timetable of another man's freedom. Now, during Birmingham, when the young black children and older kids had gone out to face down the dogs and the hoses, Bobby Kennedy calls King and says, "We can't afford a maimed child." And King bristles and says to the attorney general, "Black children are hurt every day." And they had had shouting matches. That, in some sense, changed briefly in June 11th when King gave his speech. But then Kennedy when Kennedy gave his race speech. But then they were back as the Civil Rights Bill proceeded with King's frustration and disappointment.
Well, should we separate John F. Kennedy from Bobby Kennedy? Because as we have learned, Bobby Kennedy signed off on the extensive FBI wiretaps on King and his associates. They knew everything that was being planned for the March on Washington simply because they had bugged the rooms and were listening in on the conference calls.
You know, I think the King and his coterie of closest people didn't really separate all that much, so the Kennedys at that moment operating out of the same mindset. However, if you talk to, you know, Wyatt Walker, Andrew Young, the whole group of them, they seem to have a little bit more lilt in their voice when they talk about what Bobby Kennedy became. And, you know, we never got to see if John Kennedy had that capability for moral outrage in the same way that Bobby did.
Now, why Birmingham? Was it a worst-case example that were they trying to prove something there?
Well, I think their view was that after Albany, you know, they needed a victory, and they had to do it in a more planful way, but that if they could crack this most racist of Southern towns with Bull Connor presiding, then they would, what they said, the walls of segregation would come crumbling down.
My guest is Jonathan Ryder. He's a professor of sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University, the author of a number of books, the most recent, Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail, and The Struggle for That Changed the Nation. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jonathan Ryder, professor of sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University, the author of The Word of the Lord is Upon Me, The Righteous Performance of Martin Luther King Jr., also Canarsie, The Jews and Italians of Brooklyn Against Liberalism. His latest is Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle that Changed the Nation. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. Why was he put into solitary confinement after he was arrested?
Well, Bull Connor had the wisdom to realize, I don't think he knew the backstory about King and his fear of being alone in jail, but Ralph Abernathy from inside the police car overheard Connor saying, "Let's separate." He gave the order, "Separate these two, the Daisy twins. They've never been separated." And
separate but equal cells?
Separate but equal, solitary confinement, no mattress for the first 4 days, kind of rough.
No mattress?
No. And when King first gets out of jail and he says, you know, usually in mass meetings, he wanted to buck up fellow blacks. He didn't give a hint of his vulnerability, but you hear him say in this clipped tone, "It was kind of rough on us." But so there was a conscious desire to separate them. And so King is in jail.
How long?
Well, he's in jail 8 days. But before he gets out of solitary, those first 3 or 4 days, and you cannot understand Letter from Birmingham Jail in the proper context without understanding his emotional and his personal state. He goes into jail Friday night. He plunges into panic and depression. And here's a man who used to tell black mass meetings, "They can put you in jail and transform you to glory. You may get scarred up sometime in your body, but a scarred up body is worse than a scarred up soul." And suddenly the grand leader was fragile and faltering. And so the initially, you know, he's in a terrible state. He's been mad at blacks for not following his lead. And then he reads this critique of him by eight white ministers. And when King tells about that, he tells it as an act of black solidarity. You're in jail, you meet a friend, and they know what you represent. A black trustee sneaks it to him, and suddenly King reads that they said it's untimely and that you're an extremist. He's rising up out of the valley of depression on a surge of indignation.
Well, they are self-described moderate white clergymen. They are people who actually had recently signed a document condemning George Wallace's inauguration speech, pledging support for segregation.
They were moderates in the context of the South, and they have to be given some credit. They got death threats for saying, you know, condemning Wallace's inflammatory inaugural speech. But when King says, he's in the letter from Birmingham jail, when he turns prophet, and he's not exactly addressing those eight, but the white church more generally, he says, I've driven by your churches and wondered, who are these people? What sort of people worship there? Who is their God? And he says, I have heard you condemn, I've heard you urge following the law of desegregation because it's the law, but not because the Negro is your brother. And if you look at the statement that those eight white clergymen signed, there is no moral stance against segregation.
Well, I would assume that since they were in the area, that they had segregated churches. That was Bull Connor really was very had some pretty strict laws about that.
Oh, they were absolutely the pews were segregated, the most segregated hour, as King liked to preach it. And the one rabbi, there were not blacks in the synagogue, and there's no doubt that Rabbi Grafman was a relatively decent fellow, although he always felt that the letter itself unfairly cast him as a racist, but that's another story. Absolutely. What had they done? And King was basically saying in the letter, you see the Christian radicalism. His model was the early Christians who were imbued, intoxicated by God, and these men hid behind stained glass windows.
What reaction was there to the fact that he had been put in jail for so long? Was this a national issue?
You know, the nation was aware of it, but it didn't really stir all that much outrage. You've got to remember, the Washington Post, Time Magazine, New York Times were critical of King's protests.
And the Washington Post has just recently apologized for not even mentioning the I Have a Dream speech for the March on Washington.
Robert Kaiser's excellent piece there. But what was important, so you have to understand that in terms of the media framing of King, that only when the young blacks went out on D-Day, May 2nd, which was 10 days after King got out of jail, and King was being cautious. He didn't want to use the young people. It was the young black defiance that ended up winning the day. And it is only the next day, May 3rd, when the battle-scarred kids hosed down and the dogs attacking. That's the point at which the New York Times actually came on board. And it's when President Kennedy, you hear him the next morning at a private meeting with the Americans for Democratic Action, he's saying he's befuddled. He's horrified by what he's seen. He's defensive. I know we haven't done enough, but if I was Negro, I'd be sore. So, you know, that is, so the reaction really is to the sanguinary moment of violence. And there's an irony there because it does suggest that King's original view was correct. We will have to suffer as our Savior on the cross did in order to dramatize to the nation, because the letter from Birmingham jail basically argues white people, not very many of them, have empathy for the black struggle, and morally appealing to them through high-flying oratory alone is not going to bring them around.
Do you think that Kennedy was also responding to the kind of shock that was being expressed throughout the world when the footage of Bull Connor you know, and the hoses and the beating of protesters was released all over the world?
You know, one of the things that I have been able to do to make sense of the letter, but also the Birmingham, is rely on rare recordings of King in the mass meetings and that bring this alive. You hear King on May 10th when victory is announced, and he says, "President Kennedy, when he saw that picture of the dog and it went out to Africa and Asia, and he is fighting for the minds of billions of people in the neutralist world, and he said, 'Bobby, you better get your man down there.'" Well, that man was Burke Marshall, the assistant justice for civil rights. King understands that whatever the moral motives in Kennedy, there's a lot of Cold War rail politic driving this. And the other thing that Kennedy says in his June 11th speech that King comes to understand, and it's kind of problematic for his love of nonviolence, what Kennedy says is the fires of discord are burning in all our cities. It is the fear of black violence that starts to drive the Democratic administration in much of America.
We are still hearing about the fear of black violence. There were people in conservative areas in the conservative media who were predicting that there would be riots all over the country after the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman decision. Didn't happen. But there were also predictions, of course, that the March on Washington would be violent. That didn't happen either. But you mentioned that he was disappointed by the lack of support that he was receiving when he was sent to jail. Were the protests in Birmingham supported at all by the African-American churches in the city?
Andrew Young estimated that about 5% of the black churches took part in the Birmingham struggle.
Why such a small amount?
Well, you know, there are many reasons for it. For one thing, the Atlanta people, there's a resentment of the big men from Atlanta coming into the local preserve and sort of acting, you know, saying jump and how high. A lot of the clergymen had financial and other interests that King always said, you know, you've got a nice life. But his critique of those few African-Americans who are doing well and are afraid to be with their people was another factor. There was the fear of Bull Connor retaliation. There were many things that explain that. But you hear King in one mass meeting, he says, when he's really frustrated, and he says to the clergy, "If you can't stand up for your people, what kind of religious leader you are." And we think of King in this universalist sense, concerned about brotherhood, but the other side of King was his love and loyalty to what he called my people. And in the mass meetings, you hear King talking about Negroes in Birmingham who are traitors to their race. It's a bitter King who emerges sometime, and he sees, most of the time he's very tender, that blacks have been damaged by segregation. He is wants to give them balm for the wounds of segregation so they will have the nerve to walk out the church. But at that moment, a frazzled King is really angry at his fellow folks.
My guest is Jonathan Rieder, R-I-E-D-E-R, his latest book, Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed the Nation. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How much was he thinking about Gandhi's famous letters from jail that played such an important role in India's fight for independence from Britain?
You've gone right to the heart of what's kind of mythologization of King and Gandhi. King never had the intense involvement with Gandhi in the early years in particular.
That was more Bayard Rustin.
That was Bayard Rustin trying to bring him along. And when he finally did get influenced by Gandhi, it was more by Gandhi's tactics. He goes to India in the early 60s, I believe. But the important thing is that King was a master of framing whatever was his position was in terms of the audience he needed to. His view of nonviolence came out of the black church. And so you really hear King mention Gandhi in his sermons or in his mass meetings. When he gives the Howard University Gandhi lecture, there's like two sentences on Gandhi. And there was some resentment of by some of his staff saying, you know, we don't need to go beyond the black church. Jesus tells us, turn the other cheek, love those who despise you, you know, bless those who curse you. So, you know, that's the Gandhi is not an important influence, which is why, you know, and I think of the letter in Gospel of Freedom, I really break it up into these six vignettes. There's only one of six vignettes where he actually gets into the morality and legitimacy of civil disobedience. And, you know, he then quotes Tillich and he's got Buber, he's going fancy, but they're like bumper stickers. They're all ways of getting across something more primal that comes out of his black freedom fighter sensibility.
So he gets the letter out. Does he wait until he is out of jail?
You know, there's a little debate about how much tweaking on the letter went on after. He gets out on the 20th. He gives that black preach version I've mentioned that nobody's heard on the 22nd. The young people go out on May 2nd. The
hosts was it published?
May 3rd. It was the media were not impressed by it. No one gave it much attention. It was mimeographed and sent around certain places. Sometime towards the end of the May, the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, publish it as a pamphlet. And early June, Christian Century finally does a full version of it. That gets it out to an even further reach. But again, as in so much of King, you know, the immediate anointment of the letter is conferred retroactively. And again, the New York Times thinks about publishing it in July, I guess, but then the New York Post has published a fragment. It doesn't make that big a fuss and impact until over the years as it undergoes a kind of ascension and coronation. And you know, you got to remember that a lot of King's colleagues said, why is he bothering writing a bunch of white preachers? Wyatt Walker told me, he said, that's what we expected from white preachers. We've got to deliver black people. We don't care about them. And King is in a snit because it's gotten him deep in the viscera.
And do we know how the white minister has reacted to his letter?
You know, almost universally, initially, they were either hostile or defensive. What's more interesting is over time, the path of three of them. Or I'll say two. The Episcopalian Bishop Carpenter is a hard case who just becomes something like a neo-Confederate of sorts. And that goes on. By Selma, he's even worse, hardened and angry, although he didn't support Brown v. Board. He was just shaped by the world he grew up in. Rabbi Grafman is interesting because he was a reform rabbi who felt he was a decent man, but he was almost like somebody suffering from traumatic stress syndrome. He couldn't get over all the New York Jews who wrote him and said, you're a Shonda, you're a disgrace to the Jew, you're, you know, Himmler, you're, you know. And he had a very narcissistic reading for decades saying, you know, King called me a racist, when King really was using them to make a larger statement. But Grafman played a very important role in racial healing after the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church and for decades after. The interesting one is Father Doric, the Catholic priest. He goes on to be head of the Diocese of Nashville and Memphis. And what he says is, I didn't understand at first, even though I didn't like segregation, I didn't understand it like Dr. King explained it. I came to realize his words were loving, but they were hard to me. And he, you know, King was the great sampler, always taking people's other's words. In one of the memorial services, Father Doric will quote King as his own words, criticizing the appalling silence of moderates. And he's really going, you know, criticizing himself in... He has undergone, really, he's finally accepted King's call to the prophetic mandate.
Now, following King's release, you mentioned the Children's Crusade, which led to police action that just appalled the nation and led President Kennedy to make his famous speech on race to the nation. And then there was the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. That followed as well. Did King feel guilt for having set any of these things into motion?
You know, it's hard to assess that. When he was going back after he had heard about the killing of those four little girls, he did tell Wyatt Walker, you know, we're going to be blamed for this. And in fact, the mother of one of the four girls decided to have a separate funeral. And King went and talked to her and said, no, let's have them all together at 16th Street Baptist Church. And she said, I realize that my daughter was killed because of the movement. She wasn't berating him. So I think that hurt King a little bit. But you have to remember what he always understood, that blacks were going to have to take the risk of dying. And one of the things, I've got a great story in my book in which he's saying, White Walker is saying, you know, King was always told us, I'm not going to live till I'm 40. And we thought he was exaggerating or being melodramatic. But he understood racism better than we did. And after Medgar Evers was killed, the day after John Kennedy's June 11 speech, what Andrew Young said was, that's what got us, because we suddenly realized the gains we were making were unraveling the minds of white racists. And we realized there's going to be tough stuff ahead. And the four little girls were killed. Remember, that's just like 2 or 3 weeks after the mountaintop of I Have a Dream.
We have very little time left, but I want to address another thing that you have in this book. You argue that the letter influenced other civil rights movements in other parts of the world. What are some examples of how it has been used during more recent protest movements?
Well, there's a kind of irony here, which is the letter itself has absolutely no impact on the Birmingham struggle that sets in mind all the great events that we know about. The young teenagers who went out of 16th Street Baptist Church against the fire hoses, they hadn't read it. They didn't know about it. Over time, when King in 1964 gets the Nobel Prize, it begins to spread the word globally. And the way the speech given introducing him by the head of the Nobel Committee is, these are words given to mankind. And from there, Polish solidarity. When Lech Walesa came to this country to address Congress, he sent two of his people to Birmingham to tell Andrew Young, we learned so much from the letter and from what you folks did. And one of the things we learn is always give our opponents a face-saving way out. It plays a powerful role in the sermons in the fight against apartheid. It's translated into Farsi and Arabic and has appeared among intellectuals, not necessarily at the mass level. But here's the other thing to keep in mind. King was always straddling his fierce loyalty as a black man and his love of all mankind. And what we don't understand about the letter is the ending. He does not end on a note of beloved community or mankind around the world. Why do I have confidence that we're going to win? He doesn't mention religious sources, which you know what he really believes, right? Resurrection follows crucifixion. The promised land follows bondage. It's because he has contempt and dismay towards the people who've criticized him. It's a cold ending. And he doesn't mention the American dream except briefly. He says, we buked and scorned. He's quoting the famous gospel song, buked and scorned though we may be. We were here before Jefferson wrote the magnificent words of the Declaration of Independence. And it ends with veneration of the black ancestors, as I Have a Dream does. And when you think of that, both the letter and I Have a Dream are not only about brotherhood, they're also about a tremendously proud black man who in I Have a Dream gave black slaves the final word.
Jonathan Ryder is professor of sociology at Barnard College at Columbia University. His latest book is Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed the Nation. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Really, really delight to be here.